Hey everyone, and welcome to Hobbs and Friends of the OSR, where we talk about OSR games and the games that we've played this week. I'm Jason Hobbs, and this week I'm chatting with Eric Hoffman, one of the duo of the Stormlord Publishing. Hey Eric, what's going on?
Hey Hobbs, what's happening?
It's early in the morning and this is our first episode, so who knows?
It's going to be great.
You want to take a brief introduction for yourself and tell me about you?
Sure. So I'm Eric Hoffman. Hobbs said, one of two owner, publisher, writers for Stormlord Publishing with my partner, Carl Bussler. And we make gaming supplements for old school games, DCC, Swords and Wizardry. We have a line of zines called Black Powder, Black Magic for a gritty Western six guns and sorcery genre for the Dungeon Crawl Classics role-playing game.
Yeah, that's great. I've played it. I've actually ran it at a few cons now, and I enjoy Black Powder Black Magic immensely. The only thing that could be better about it is if they came out in a more timely manner.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, we have day jobs.
Yeah, I understand that for sure. So Eric and I play quite a few games together, almost weekly, actually. And one of those games is with Jay Murphy. He wrote us a supplement or a hack of another game called USR Sword and Sorcery. And USR stands for Unbelievably Simple Role Playing. This was my first session of the game, and I guess it sounds like it's just coming back after a few months hiatus. But Eric's been playing it for a while. And Eric, you want to have anything to say about it?
Yeah, sure. So a guy named Scott Malthouse wrote this this pretty simple rule system called Unbelievably Simple Role-Playing, and it's a generic role-playing system that I've been playing with Jay for about 3 years now. Right when this USR came out, Jay picked it up and started running a Conan-esque, Howard-esque Swords and Sorcery campaign, and over the course of about 3 years of online play with people coming and going, he developed his own, like Hob said, hack, or really just genre book, I guess, for USR called USR Swords and Sorcery. And so he just published that, and we reinvigorated the campaign and invited Hobbs. I'm not sure why, but we did. and so we just got our first session in this week, and it was nice to revisit those characters who've kind of been all over the world in true Conan-esque fashion.
We'll have a link in the show notes to both of those products. And it seems like Scott Malthouse uses Trollish Delver Games as his publication. So if you're ever looking for that, you'll be able to find it. The setting is the world of Zoth. I thought it was an original setting until I started to do some research about it. Have you ever looked into that at all before, Eric?
No, I thought it was original too. And I thought Jay was a genius because he was always coming up with his amazingly weird pulpy swords and sorcery stuff. And then he came clean and let us know he was pulling a while ago from this setting that I had never heard of before or since. But it's a pretty fantastic.
Yeah.
Real swords and sandals, swords and sorcery type setting.
Yeah, I'd never heard of it. And it doesn't hardly have any of your regular medieval England type of stuff in the fluff whatsoever. It, like you say, Sword and Sandal is great about what it is. Levantine kind of Mesopotamian or whatever. You get that feeling. I should say that I think the stuff he was using when you guys traveled across the world is not in the book. So I downloaded the player's guide because it's free. I will have a link in the show notes about that. Did you look at any of that or no?
No. So I kind of purposely avoided reading about the setting. Like I a while ago I briefly skimmed it to kind of see where he was getting stuff from, but I didn't delve any deeper because I didn't want any of the mysteries of the world revealed, because it was so much fun just exploring this setting. And kind of like true murder hobo vagabonds, we went off the map about a year and a half ago, and so he started pulling from other things, I guess, or made up on his own a whole Far East type of setting. We went off the east side of the map on a ship, and we're just getting back onto it. So I don't know where he pulled that additional information from.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I didn't look at it too much. I just saw there was a PDF, and so I was like, this is interesting. Because it's not very often that you do see someone have a, as far as the people I role play with, have a, you know, a strong grasp of those different types of cultures like he seems to.
Yeah, he's really got, Jay's a deep Appendix N reader, from what I understand. He's like read a lot of stuff, really been around the hobby for a long time and into the genre for a long time. So he's able to, he's also real good at improvising and pulling out kind of weird stuff and going with it off the cuff. the opposite of me. I have to be kind of prepared for what's going to happen to some degree. You know, as a default, I've gotten better throughout the years, but he can really just kind of rip and run with stuff he's read before and kind of weave an adventure evening whole cloth out of that. Another great reason he's able to do that is the system. So we haven't talked much about that, but it is unbelievably simple. It's really, I don't know if you're going to get into the mechanics of it, but it allows you to kind of overlay it to any kind of a scenario with a couple of die rolls to resolve it, but it does then rely a lot on the ability of the game master to explain, you know, what the dice say and kind of put some of their own setting rules on top of it.
Yeah, I don't see any reason why we can't talk about the system itself. So character generation just uses something similar to Savage Worlds. You have three dice, a D10, a D8, and a D6, and you apply them to the three attributes, right? Which is agility, ego, wits, right?
Action, I think, ego and wits.
Oh, yeah, not agility, right, action. And from that, you basically do everything in the game other than your specialisms, which are similar to Fate or PDQ, where you have a +2 for whatever it is you choose. You get three of those, and I guess you're trying to keep them relatively on the same level of broadness for each character if you're concerned about balance, I guess, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. There's no list of specialisms. The genre or whatever setting you use kind of determines that. So in Jay's Sword and Sorcery USR book, for an example, the example character is Door Striker, a warrior and executioner's guard, which he rolled on these background tables that are included. And for example, his specialisms are close combat, drive chariot, and leadership. So anytime that he does something in the game that relates to those three things, he gets to add his specialism bonus of +2 to the die roll. And that's it. That's a character. And then hits, too. You have hit points, basically. So you have action, wits, ego, hits, and three specialisms, and your character's done.
So why don't you talk about your character some?
Sure. So I made a character completely random back when we started this. I wanted to be a warrior, so I assigned 10 to action, which is all of your kind of combat stuff. It's any actions, physical actions you take. And then I rolled on the tables, and I got a farmer and a peasant defender background. So I kind of developed this nascent Conan-esque character called Farouk, and he's gone by many monikers as he's traveled the world and accumulated achievements and enemies and been aged by a ghost. And so now he's 53 years old, kind of looks like Jack LaLanne, you know, this because he aged it all at once. So he's this perfect specimen of 50-some-year-old warrior who's just kind of gotten in and out of scrapes. He's had a bunch of treasures that have quickly been taken, and a real kind of brash guy. And somehow he's survived because there is been character death in the campaign. This is not a snowflake, you know, the character never dies type of world. But Farouk has somehow always managed to slither through to the next adventure, albeit weakened with more enemies and less treasure.
Yeah, I wasn't surprised that you named the character Farouk because I've seen that in other games that you've played, and also being a warrior because that seems to be what you really like to play.
Yeah, I guess. I think it's I don't want to do math or keep track of stuff at the table, so, you know, spells and all that, thieves' abilities, you know, I don't know. I do enjoy warriors probably primarily, but, you know, you mentioned that to me this week in gaming, and I was like, man, I got to start playing some other stuff now because I'm typecast in RPGs.
I think it's true. And I'm not even sure who Jack LaLanne is, by the way. So,
He's an old fitness guy. He's like old and I don't know. Look him up.
Is he the Pilates guy?
I don't know if he did. I don't think so. He had some weight system, maybe Bowflex or something before. Anyway, we're really on the tangent.
That's all
like
right.
In the 80s, I think he was like a health guru. But anyway.
All right, so the character that I knew very little about what was going on in the game. It was obvious that you guys talked, and like when I heard you and Jay talking about it, there was a vast background that I was going to have no knowledge of whatsoever. And with the way the characters are made, it's not like you have classes or anything, so you don't have a niche to fill, which is what I like to do when I'm making a character, probably. So all I did is, he had said he'd never had a character cast magic before, and since it's a sword and sorcery campaign, at first I was wondering if only evil characters were, you know, spellcasters, because in Conan, if someone cast magic, it normally ended up being a foil of his or a villain of some sort.
I was going to say, so far in the campaign, that's kind of what we've encountered is all the magicians. It's been really kind of both off-screen and diabolical enemies type guys. And not really, it's definitely not the Vancian, you know, memorize fire type of spell system in Dungeons & Dragons.
Yeah, it does. Well, nothing about it really seems Dungeons & Dragons other than the maybe the overreaching tropes of a fantasy game in general. So the character that I made, you need ego to cast spells, it says, and you need high wits to learn them. So that pretty much left me with taking a D6 on my action die, which with my naivety or neophism of the game itself, I had no comprehension of what that would even entail, you know. But once we started playing, and then you start to realize, I don't know, 75% of the things you do in a fantasy role-playing game is an action. So I was like, oh, I'm only going to have a D6 on almost everything that I do for the majority of the game until I actually get magic.
Yeah, a lot of that's kind of what you choose to do. Jay has been throughout the course of the campaign really good about letting kind of big stuff happen with other roles. So one of Farouk's specialisms is leadership, and he's gotten like a small army together at times, never last, but to take like campaign objectives. So that is, you know, kind of the standard dungeon delve type scenario. If you're just fighting it, it's all about action, but you know, you can run it any way that you want. And it's as much as the GM's going to allow you to do with the other kind of roles.
Yeah. The system itself doesn't niche itself like, say, a BX or something, where the whole basic book is only about dungeon delving, you know? There's nothing else. So in this, the mechanics lead themselves to social conflict or interaction as much as it does action. So I'm hoping that's the game will go that way. So we've talked about the mechanics and about our characters some. What do you think about Jay's specific style of running that game? Do you think that it is indicative of any game of USR, or do you think Jay's particular style? Well, I'll talk about what I think first, I guess, this time, even though you're the guest. So to me, a large portion of it was really monologue from Jay kind of describing what happened, because there is such a backlog of information going on in the game, and what is kind of this transition period of, okay, what is the game going to be now? And there was in many systems that would have been a pretty big fight, but in that system, I mean, it took 15 minutes for the 5-player characters to hew down 12 assassins that attacked us. So the specific style, as far as Jay is concerned, really describing the setting in detail. And it's important because, like we said, it's not a medieval setting. So it's more other cultures than what a lot of people are necessarily used to. So I really appreciated that as far as I'm concerned, because otherwise I don't have the 2 years of background that you guys have. So it was really nice to get as much information as possible.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's a lot. It's really exploring this world and the setting and even the scenarios we're in, you know, in every detail, not just literally exploring the next town or the wilderness, but kind of, you know, talking about this rich background that's going on. For example, in the scenario we did this week, we were in this town and we had been there a while ago and we were working for this merchant. And the way this town is run is it's taboo in this town for anyone to see your face. So everyone wears a mask, and they're all a part of these different guilds, and depending on who you are, you wear a mask, and a lot of them are, like, totemistic. So we worked for this guy who, Acto Korsh, who's this merchant in the Bee Clan. So all the people who are associated with this merchant guild wear a mask with a bee on it, and it's this weird stuff, and it's like, and then there's the Viper and the Scorpion clans are, like, assassins, and the Hounds are the guards and army. So this is like rich tableau of you can kind of really step in it if you do the wrong thing. And so when these assassins attacked, it was a lot about explaining. We had, you know, we were like, well, what kind of mask are they wearing? And these guys were wearing blank masks, which is like, you know, this big powerful symbol for somebody about to do something dirty, and all this stuff that's constantly needs to be explored and understood and talked about. And so when you get to the combat, it's a good thing it's a quick system, because the resolution is as quick as, you know, almost as quick as a real combat. So It's done and over with, and it's really about the situations that the characters are in more than anything. And also the group it's a couple of Jay's relatives that don't play games a lot, so it's not a kind of a veteran crowd of, you know, rulesy type of guys who know what they're doing. It's a lot of really freeform. Reminds me of playing role-playing games when I was a kid in the wonder of it, and the anything could happen and will, and so it's really refreshing because it's not the kind of game I usually play or that I default to.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And the idea that some of those guys aren't necessarily OSR veterans, the choices that they make or the actions that they want to do sometimes are, like you say, like a little kid, because they don't have these, you know, decades of, okay, now I listen at the door, now I, you know, check for traps. They're more like, hey, I want to beat this guy up and then make him think he has to join our group. You know, I was just like, so, for example, one of these assassins survived, and we wanted to try and get information from them to see why they were attacking the group. So the first idea was good cop, bad cop, but the good cop didn't last very long because basically he punched the guy, knocked him down, and said, well, since you told them what you told us what's going on, you have no other choice but to join us. So I was like, oh, okay, I guess. And Jay kind of just rolled with it, and it seemed like it happened before.
Exactly. Assassins attacked us a while ago in, I believe, the same town. Or there was some dispute about that, and they failed, and that was where Farouk used his leadership after we captured about six of them to join his crew. At the time, we had a ship with some pirates and a crew to go sailing across the world. And so they sat, you know, they were the Blue Cult Assassins, and so I had six of them as a personal bodyguard, and I forgot, I had a huge chest of silver that I'd won for doing something, and we went off into the jungle, like an away party in Star Trek, and I left all these guys on the boat with a big chest of silver, and so Jay is like, okay, well, three sessions and several months later, we get back, and he's like, well, there's one Blue Cult Assassin left, and he rolled my leadership against all these guys with big penalties, but one made it, and he defended my silver, and killed a couple. I mean, it was nuts, right? All the stuff that can go on. And the cool thing about it with the system is that kind of stuff, there's not a lot of mechanics for that, right? There's three mechanics. And so it's real easy to kind of figure the percentages in your head as a GM and say, okay, this is what it's going to be. Roll, roll, roll. Story moves along. And in that case, it did. And it was a really cool result that is memorable.
Yeah. Just like we said that the characters or the players have a broader spectrum of actions they can do, the GM kind of does as well. I'm not saying it's more than any other OSR game, but it's almost easier to resolve those things because of the limited mechanics.
Yeah, and it's definitely, God, you know, I hate to say story game, right? Because it's not. as you know, we've had this discussion before. To me, a story game is where the mechanics of the game are based around some, you know, narration or, you know, that kind of thing. But mm-hmm. it allows for the mechanics don't get in the way of the story, not that it's a story game.
Do you believe USR is an OSR game, or do you feel like maybe it is more of an indie game? Is it a trad game? I don't really know. It felt like one, but maybe it's just because of the way we were playing.
Yeah, that's a good question. I have to think about that. I mean, I guess the simplest definition of OSR, which we could spend several there are several podcasts that do that, is just, you know, is it replicating some original version of a game? And I can't specifically say of one that it does, but it definitely, to me, reminds me of playing role-playing games before I knew all the rules. You know, back in the day when you were at school and your buddy's big brother had the first three books of Dungeons and Dragons and he kind of remembered what it was about, and so you play at recess, right? There's everything's made up on the fly. You might have a six-sided die because it was in a game or something. And so we would play Dungeons and Dragons on the bus, you know, going back and forth to field trips and stuff with no dice, no books, and really none of us even owning the books because it was just one kid whose big brother had them. And it really reminded me of that.
I guess I don't know if that answers the question, but I would definitely agree with you because you're bringing me memories of sixth grade basketball on the trip, so of me running games for some of the kids. Obviously none of the starters, but everyone just sat on the bench, you know. All right. So I guess, do you have a specific moment or thing that occurred in the game that you wanted to talk about?
From this past week, yeah, I would definitely say it was the length of time between assassins bust in, and Jay's real dry. You know, we're having this, he's explaining in detail these gifts that we got from our patron, which was really cool because he didn't have it planned. He just pulled a book off his shelf and started rolling, and it was weird stuff like a jade ornamental mask, and Farouk got a horn that he immediately stood up and blew for everyone at the event. And so we're going through this description, and I'm like, okay, it's going to be like this kind of you know, big description of how awesome we are, and then we'll move on to what we want to do next. And then he's just like, and so six assassins bust in, right?
Yeah, and some poisonous cloud comes in.
Yeah, they use like a basically a flashbang grenade of magic and took out all the guards outside the door and then busted in. And we're making short work of the guards inside the banquet. And then it was literally probably 30 minutes of game time of talking about, you know, what's going on, what do these guys look like. And that was all really cool because it really set the scene. And then we sprung into action. So it reminded me of like a Howard short story where, you know, how often is Conan swinging his sword? It's like, you know, a couple sentences in the book, but there's this like rich explanation of the Tower of the Elephant and what it looks like and with the sounds. Some of my favorite Conan stories are when he's the ship captain and he's in like the jungles and like the sounds of the jungle and the primeval, all this stuff, right? This real rich explanation is my favorite moment.
Yeah, his description is fantastic for sure. And Jay did a good job of that as well. And like you say, he does it. I think this is almost indicative of the games that we play because you do it and Paul definitely the same way. It's kind of, all right, this is what's happening. Sometimes it's good. Sometimes it's bad. You know, we're just this innocent, unbiased bystander as the game master. And, you know, you just do what you do with the description as a player after that. So I really like that too. And I would agree I don't know if I really had a very favorite moment of the game, but just in general, the spectrum of what happened during a single session and just the hints of the backstory, like people only kind of remember them. It's almost like real life. You know, after 2 years of traveling across the world, you're not going to have copious notes and everything. You're just going to kind of, oh, you remember that time when we were in Zothique and da-da-da-da-da. So I thought that was pretty cool. All right, so I think that pretty much covers Jay's game. So our third thing we like to talk about is the product spotlight. So for our first episode, I really wanted to talk about Stormlord Publishing's Treasure Vaults of Zatabod, which originally came out as Dungeon Crawl Classics supplement, and then later was converted to Swords and Wizardry, which is one of the many retro clones that exist. It's basically close to the BX or Holmes or Beckme type of style of game, and that's all I'm going to say about it. Why don't you say something about it as the writer and publisher of that book?
Sure. Yeah. So Treasure Vaults of Zatabod was the first full-length module/setting book that Carl and I wrote. And probably, like a lot of publishers, we bit off more than we could chew for our first big project together. yeah. I started working with Carl. He had just written and published a zine-sized funnel for Dungeon Crawl Classics, if you're familiar with that system. It's kind of like a level zero adventure where you kind of develop your character. You know, I play tested that for him and we started talking and he said, hey, you want to write the sequel with me? So we started writing it. And it's really kind of a love letter to the Isle of Dread, which is by Zeb Cook for Expert Dungeons and Dragons way back in the day. And we kind of decided, hey, we want it to be an island hex crawl. And then we just started brainstorming. And the whole MacGuffin of it is that there's this lost city on the island that contains vast treasures and these famous treasure vaults and what's in there. There's all these rumors, right? So that's it. And we really kind of started populating it with, you know, to fit into what we're talking about here. It's a real kind of swords and sorcery type of feel. Those stories about Conan, you know, on the ship and going to different islands and jungles and stuff was a big inspiration, as well as the Isle of Dread and some of the early modules of Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah, absolutely. It's by far one of my favorite supplements. But I do want to go back to one thing you said about Dungeon Crawl Classics and describing the funnel as the place where you develop your character. Yes, you develop your character by all the other ones dying. So the one that's left is the...
Yeah, well, that's development, right?
Oh, no, it absolutely is. And I mean, that's exactly what Joel Goodman, the author of DCC, was trying to do, give you a different way other than just some random rolls on a background table. And now your character's, you know, first level or whatever. But that'll be another topic. But I definitely like the way you said it.
Yeah. I kind of saw the rat hole I could go down if I kept describing Dungeon Crawl Classics role-playing game. So that's not a description. I think addition by subtraction is the perfect short phrase elevator pitch for the DCC funnel.
Yeah, no kidding. And a lot of people seem to love it. So even people that don't think they would, but they really do enjoy it. Back to Treasure Vaults. as soon as I picked it up, I was like, wow, this does seem like a throwback, or like you mentioned, a love letter to the Isle of Dread. And it's great. It really is. And one of the things about it that I think we've found now, because how long ago did that come out, the DCC version?
Oh, wow. All right, put me on the spot. Let's see. 2014. I think okay. We released it right around Christmas. So, yeah, over two years ago.
Yeah, okay, so 2 years. But now the things that you and I have done with the supplement kind of shows how great the value of it is. I'll talk about what I did. So Eric and I play BX games, open table games, which is a whole another subject. But I've used it, and I wanted Eric to be able to play in this game that he had written. So the only way I could really do it is to take the book and push it ahead, you know, 50 years after the vaults themselves have been ransacked and supposedly a lot of the treasure already gone. And it's a love letter itself to the treasure vault. So I just find that kind of almost a full circle. And I think that's pretty cool. And Eric, why don't you mention what you have done with it?
Sure. So one of the things, we just recently converted it to Swords and Wizardry. And that's available on Lulu. We tried a big full color print, you know, really thick paper conversion, as well as a rules conversion. And then as we were doing that, Carl and I started talking about other things we could do. And we kind of, this idea got floated about Nazis on the island and a World War II game. And I recently ran exactly that, Nazi submarine bases of Zadabad, at a convention, and got a big full color poster of the map, and wrote some simple, using kind of white box Swords and Wizardry with some rules from White Lies and some ideas from, I think, Pete Spahn's World War II Operation White Box.
Yep.
And cobbled together a quick rule system and ran that at a con. And what was interesting is that, not to name drop or anything, but I've actually gotten to know David Zeb Cook, because we traveled a bunch of cons together and on a plane a lot. So he was at this convention, a little local convention, and he came by as I was running it, which was pretty neat. The author of Isle of Dread came by and watched a couple minutes as I was running this game that was, you know, Nazis on the island that he inspired. It was pretty neat moment.
Yeah, that's fantastic story, really. Of course, it's probably about the 30th time I've heard it, but I'm glad that the listeners got a chance to hear it. But yeah, it's great. And just as a teaser, Eric and I and Paul Wolf are thinking about doing something else with Treasure Vaults of Zadabad at GaryCon. So if any listeners find us there, give us a holler, and we'll invite you to the game. It'll probably be an open game, I'm thinking. Don't you think, Eric?
Yeah, I think so. Well, it's certainly not going to be on the books, because that's all over with. But yeah, I'll throw it out there. No guarantees it's going to happen, but the idea we have is we're gonna mash up Black Powder Black Magic with Treasure Vaults of Zadabad. And instead of Western gunslingers, it's going to be that late Victorian era explorers. So all the characters will be explorers from around the world at three different tables, all with different kind of objectives on the island. And there's some really weird stuff going on there that'll really mix things up, maybe even including players getting up from one table and going to the other to kind of switch teams, if you will. So still in the planning stages, but that's kind of the idea of what we want to run with.
It should be awesome. I mean, we've done multi-table games at GaryCon last year and at North Texas, but this is even a little more ambitious, I guess.
We're going to keep adding on to that theme until we break it.
We'll see if we can actually top our 22-player game from GaryCon then.
Yeah, that was close to breaking. That stressed to the limits, not only my endurance, but the physical capacity of the con, finding two tables next to each other and then borrowing enough chairs for 22 people to be involved in one game was pretty wacko.
Yeah, and only afterwards did I decide that it was probably not that nice for the people who were still in actual games, for the, you know, official on-the-books games, because we had so many people and it was pretty loud. But no one came after me afterwards, so I guess it worked out all right.
Right, yeah. Lesson learned. That's why this new idea doesn't require the tables to be next to each other, which is kind of one thing we learned by doing this.
For sure. Okay, so I'll have a link to the show notes in the where you can go to Stormlord Publishing or Lulu for Treasure Vaults. We'll have some information about that.
We're also on DriveThruRPG for PDF, so Stormlordpublishing.com, DriveThruRPG, RPG Now, and Lulu.com for a print of Treasure Vaults of Zadabod, Swords and Wizardry version.
All right, so next I'd like to have a brief discussion about the state of the OSR, which is a segment of the show where I'm going to have a particular topic of something that's happening, hopefully relatively recently, in this nebulous thing that we call the OSR. So today's topic is a blog post on Gabor Lux's blog, which is called Beyond Fomalhaut, where he basically, I would say he almost rails against a direction that some people in the OSR have been going to recently, which is minimalism, where the one-page dungeon, five-room dungeons, boiling down the entire rule set for any given game and trying to fit it on a page or two. Does that pretty much describe what we're talking about here?
Yeah, it's the title of the blog is OSR Module 01 Against the Ultra Minimalism. And that's a good description that Hobbs gave of what he's talking about.
Eric from Tenkar's Tavern, he's been all about Swords and Wizardry Lite, basically boiling down the rules of Swords and Wizardry into a simple two pages. And I see this more and more often. The one-page dungeon contest has been going on for, what, 3 years, probably?
Oh, yeah, longer than that. Been going on quite a while.
So basically what Gabor Lux is saying is he thinks it's a bad idea to boil these things down that far. What's the purpose of it, really? What do you think about that?
I found the blog post really interesting. I don't want to say I agree, and I almost get the feeling that maybe it wasn't written even 100% that he's convinced of it. So I will say that I don't know if that's his real name, but Gabor Lux wrote a bunch of stuff for Fight On magazine back in the day that is just amazing. It's really good quality stuff. It's kind of in the beginning of the OSR, and it's really kind of out there, and I love it, and I've used a lot of those materials in my own games, and actually for games that link into the Treasure Vaults of Zadabod. So I really enjoy the stuff he's written, and it is pretty minimal, right? Well, like a lot of that stuff was back in the day. And yeah, I think if you're going to boil down his whole blog post, the crux of it is, you know, simple and minimal is fine, but there's diminishing returns at a certain point where just getting simpler as the basis of what you're doing is not, it shouldn't be the reason you're doing what you're doing. And there needs to be some kind of context, something or some kind of originality, or it becomes just too simple. And I will agree with that.
I would too. And he's also basically saying that the stuff that people are saying is the successful examples of these minimalist adventures or something. If you didn't have the background already, like he talks about the one-page Caves of Chaos by Zach Smith, if you didn't already know the Keep on the Borderlands, you would not really be able to run the module with just this one page.
You know, the other thing too is that without some interesting twist or context around it, I mean, it's not really anything worth printing, right? I mean, just a map with four kobolds, six goblins, I mean, that's not really helpful to anybody. And I also don't like going too far in the other direction either, which you and I have talked about this, you know, offline, but I have a real problem with modules where a standard, you know, 30-page module, the first 15 pages are all about the unique snowflake setting that this module exists in. And, yeah, not picking on people, but like products where, oh, well, in this world, you know, elves are, you know, purple and their ears, you know, are long, not pointed. And that's a critical part of the module. Or, you know, dwarves, you know, they make each other out of rock or something. And it's like, it's useless. Like you're going to say it's kind of useless to the guy running a campaign who wants to pick up an adventure to drop in. You've got to cut half the material out and then read the rest carefully to make sure that it doesn't hinge on any of those things in the first half.
Totally.
So sometimes that stuff's interesting to read, but it's not useful as a game material.
Right. Yeah. It seems like you're putting something in that's no one's going to use anyway, and which is kind of what started the minimalist movement, I believe, is just this wall of text. All right, I think that pretty much wraps up our first episode. Lastly, I'd like to let our listeners know where they could contact you if they wanted to. Like, where are you at out there on the interwebs, Eric?
Yeah, so stormlordpublishing.com for any kind of our products. Also on Google Plus, Eric Hoffman, ERICHOFFMAN.
And I can be found on Twitter at HobbsIndeed or on the Googles at Jason Hobbs. Well, thanks a lot, Eric, for being our first guest. I really enjoyed it, as I always enjoy talking to you, and hopefully we can do it again.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.